Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
More coming up, but first a quick diversion into global media to see what other outlets have said. Here's how they put it in print. The Financial Tribune reads, Iran's first combine tea harvester, rice seedling planter unveiled. The first combine tea harvester and rice seedling planter made in Iran have been unveiled and production lines have been set up for their large-scale industrial production, according to the head of the Agricultural Mechanization Expansion Center. The combine tea harvester has a 74-horsepower engine and can reap yields from 2 hectares of farms per day. Talking of trade with Africa, the Monitor reads, Museveni seeks barter trade with Iran government. President Museveni has proposed barter trade, the exchange of goods for goods and services for services, as one of the ways of boosting trade with sanctions hit Iran, because it would bypass the global banking system, which predominantly uses the United States dollar. The Uganda-Iran barter trade system would certainly attract scrutiny from Washington, which gives Uganda nearly $1 billion each year, mainly for health and security support. The State Minister for International Relations, Mr. Okello Oryem, told Daily Monitor last evening that there is no standard way of trading around the world, and by engaging in barter trade, Kampala would not be breaking any international law. We've a piece that puts my mind to ease because I was so worried about the escape of brains from this country. The Tehran Times reads, Iranian knowledge-based products hit markets in 70 countries. Iranian knowledge-based companies that marketed their products in 70 countries and in some global markets have overtaken European and American companies, Siavash Maliki said. He's deputy head of the Innovation and Prosperity Fund. In the last 2 days, the number of knowledge-based companies has exceeded 6,800, he stated, emphasizing that half of them are active in the field of electronics and electricity. Last year, knowledge-based companies gained about $800 million in revenues from export, and in the current year, which started March the 21st, it seems to have reached over $1 billion. Today, the country's knowledge-based ecosystem accounts for more than 3% of the GDP, he said. That'll be it for the news segment today. Here in the second half of the show, it's about time for more facts and figures. Exports in Iran increased to $18,850 million in 2022 from $17,285 million in the second quarter of 2021. That's according to the CBI, Central Bank of Iran. Oil and natural gas being Iran's most important exports, they account for 82% of the country's export revenues thus far. Other exports include chemicals, plastics, fruit, ceramic products, and metals. This country's foreign trade hit over 41.5 million tons, valued at over $29.5 billion in the last 3 months of the previous Persian year, or first quarter of 2022, according to Said Ruhollah Latifi, that spokesman for IRICA, Iran's Customs Administration. Iran exported under 30.5 million tons of non-oil goods, valued at under $13.5 billion from January the 22nd to March the 20th, 2022. Recording a 10 and 39% growth in terms of weight and value, respectively, said Latifi. Over $122.7 million worth of products were exported from the country last year, showing a 9 and 40% growth in terms of weight and value, respectively, as compared to the same period of the year before.
Our technical and engineering exports can take over our oil exports. I was gathering information about an expo in Syria, and I saw that Iran has failed to take part in that expo. This is while Iran has played a big role in the reconstruction of Syria, as well as providing raw materials and engineering services. But for some reason, Iran missed out on that event.
Now, to go back to alliances, as far as the focus on neighbors goes, President Raisi stated the Islamic Republic of Iran has a high geopolitical capacity that provides the basis for strengthening regional convergence and the spread of peace and prosperity among the nations of the region from the Indian Ocean and Persian Gulf and Black Sea to Europe.
In the first year of Iran's current administration, we had an average increase of 30% in our export levels. Therefore, if we continue with the same speed, it's possible to achieve the $75 billion targets by the end of the current administration's four-year term. But we have to take into account that improving exports requires preconditions. I mean, if we have the target of $75 billion of exports, we have to improve the knowledge of our cooperation and improve our packaging industry, which is one of our weak points. We also need to have plans to improve our transportation. Weakness in transportation has already damaged our foreign trade badly. We need to have plans to provide more refrigerator trucks for our agricultural sector.
Then there's the potential Iran-Russia-Venezuela energy bloc. Those three countries have huge potential to thwart sanctions on their energy sectors if they cooperate, Iran maintains. An alliance of the sanctions club, so to speak. Although U.S. sanctions against the energy industries of these three countries are of a different nature in each case. The Iran-Russia-Venezuela energy axis would have great potential to influence world markets, given they hold 45% of the world's oil reserves. Venezuela, with the world's largest oil reserves, has 303 billion barrels of crude, while Iran has 157 billion and Russia 89 billion. Iran has been lending Venezuela a helping hand since 2020. To revive that country's oil and refining industries. How? By sending technical help and shipping oil and gasoline to the Latin American country. Also, recently, the two states signed a good many agreements during Venezuelan President Maduro's visit to Iran. As for how much the Ukraine war might have affected Iranian sales, Iran says its oil sales have remained at relatively high levels as it is exporting more than 1 million barrels of crude oil and gas condensate per day. And it's not just down to global oil prices having increased, basically because of the Ukraine war, but because there has been a considerable increase in actual oil sales by the government and more success in receiving the money for it. Outside sources, however, have claimed that Iran's crude exports have taken a big hit given Western sanctions on Russia have prompted that country to pump its oil east with a discount, greater discounts than Iran has managed to give China, its largest buyer of oil.
Iran is an oil-rich country, and its budget has been based on oil sales until 3 years ago, when the U.S. unfair sanctions hit the country hard. When the administrations faced problems in providing foreign exchange resources, they turned to non-oil exports, and at the end of the previous administration, we succeeded in providing the required financial resources from non-oil exports.
Earlier in April, Oil Minister Javad Orji said Iran's oil production levels had reached the pre-sanctions levels of over 3.8 million barrels. Among reasons for this, he said, were finding new customers and markets, using different methods and oil contracts, and making use of highly qualified experts in the field. Also, according to Orji, Iran's gas condensate exports rose nearly fourfold over 8 months. They reached nearly 240,000 barrels per day at the end of the calendar year leading up to March the 20th, 21st. That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. We'll be back on at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The GAO reports the mind-boggling statistic that the United States Department of Defense has administered $54.6 billion in aid to Saudi Arabia and the UAE during the Yemen war. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Juan Cole, author. This article is published under the heading, As Biden Visits Saudi Arabia, GAO Report Spotlights Deadly U.S. Role in Yemen Disaster. Here's the story. One of the failures of President Biden has been completely disengaging the U.S. from the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which he had pledged to do. Although there has been a successful two-month ceasefire, the war could flare back up at any time. The Biden administration has vowed only to provide the Saudis with defensive weaponry, but there is no firm definition for such things in the U.S. legal code. The Government Accountability Office, or GAO, has issued a new report on the role of U.S.-provided weaponry in civilian deaths in Yemen war, many of them the result of war crimes. Since Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and their allies launched a war on Yemen in 2015, some quarter of a million people have been killed, most by disease and hunger caused by the war, and half the population has been made food insecure. Of those killed in airstrikes, about 17,000 are known to have been civilian non-combatants, according to the UN. In late January of this year alone, Saudi and UAE fighter jets supplied by the U.S. hit three primarily civilian sites, including a hospital and El Telecommunications Corporations. The strikes killed 80 civilians and caused 156 injuries, and that was just 1 2-week period. Deutsche Welle reported on one of these January air strikes. The GAO reports the mind-boggling statistic that the United States Department of Defense has administered $54.6 million in aid to Saudi Arabia and the UAE during the Yemen war. Somebody should be fired for that right there. First of all, Saudi Arabia and the UAE are fabulously wealthy oil states and do not need any aid from the US. Second of all, the aid was in furtherance of a horrible illegal war in which the US should never have been involved. Any aid that involved the transfer of US weapons to two countries was actually corporate welfare, intended to throw government money to American arms corporations. The bulk of US aid to the Egyptian military junta takes this form. Egyptians never see it except in the form of Apache helicopters in Egyptian military warehouses. Although the GAO notes that the US military provided targeting and strategic advice to the Saudis during the war, it neglects to say that where the US advised against hitting targets that would cause severe civilian crises, including bridges and ports, the Saudis often disregarded this advice. The US officer corps in Saudi Arabia grew so annoyed by this behavior that they leaked it anonymously to the Washington Post to little avail. One major takeaway of the GAO report is that although according to the US law, the Saudis that is are not supposed to use American weaponry to kill or harm civilian non-combatants, whether intentionally or through reckless disregard for civilian life, the State Department has not undertaken any serious study of the way the Saudi-led coalition has deployed those weapons. The GAO writes, states submitted an initial certification in 2018 that the Saudi and Emirati governments had made efforts to reduce harm to civilians in Yemen, but did not submit two subsequent required certifications. Although state's initial certification was complete, its supporting documentation, not required by law, did not address all elements required in the certification. What? The state hasn't even bothered to track the US weapons impact. The GAO says that the Department of Defense has undertaken and published such reports on Yemen. They say that the DOD maintains that the Saudis and UAE have made efforts toward reducing the harm of the war to civilians, which is patently untrue. The Saudis and UAE launched an air war on Yemen in 2015. There have been bipartisan congressional resolutions demanding that the U.S. dissociates itself from the Yemen war, but they were vetoed by successive U.S. presidents.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Try making conversation by showing an interesting newspaper article to a person sitting next to you somewhere in the U.S., and there's a good chance that he or she will not be able to read it. According to the U.S. Department of Education, half of the U.S. adult population cannot read above the sixth grade level. Experts believe there has been a literacy crisis in the United States, and in some ways, it's only become worse. Literacy problem is not only restricted to adults. American children also have serious literacy issues. More than a million students drop out of U.S. schools each and every year, never finishing high school.
I can't read.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And in this episode, we'll discuss the literacy crisis in America. How is illiteracy among many adults impacting society and the economy? And how long has the country been trying to tackle the literacy problem? And does social and racial discrimination play a role in the literacy crisis in the United States? As usual, we're pleased to have our two guests on our show, Shabbir Manji Rizvi from the Party for Socialism and Liberation from Chicago, and John Gehan, Master's in Public Administration from Harvard University and a Master's in Mass Communication and Journalism from the University of Minnesota. Stay tuned.
Historically, the American elite and officials have considered many rights and liberties as privileges only given to certain segments of society. Denying various rights has been a source and method of control and oppression. During a great length of U.S. history, literacy and the ability to read was a privilege only upper-class white men enjoyed. Free schools did not exist, and the poor and minorities, especially African Americans, were not allowed to receive education. The objective was to preserve a class system, one in which ensured that the poor never rose from poverty and stayed under the authority and power of the elite white man.
It is worse than we can think or comprehend. Millions of African American men are unable to read.
After the slave revolt of 1831, all slave states except for Maryland, Kentucky, and Tennessee made it illegal by law to teach slaves to read and write. Now, those who would teach a free person of color or a slave to read or write would be fined somewhere between $250 and $500, which was quite a large sum of money back then. Now, those in power were worried that if a slave would learn to read, they would access more information and revolt against them. So what is the status of literacy among Americans today?
Well, I think the average literacy in terms of reading, for example, if we understand literacy to be skills in reading, that may be around the third to fourth grade, which is a very low level. It's where maybe a 10-year-old would be reading if they were making normal progress. I think literacy could be understood in several ways. One is obviously just the ability to read and write and understand language, vocabulary, grammar, that type of thing. Another way of looking at literacy is understanding kind of the social world, the world of how well does a person understand geography and history, and how well can someone engage in the social and political life of the world. On that level, I think Americans are very weak. They tend to have a very limited understanding of the world around them.
Today, the literacy rate fluctuates between racial and socioeconomic groups. Minority communities and races have much lower literacy rates than the majority of white upper class. According to the McKinsey and Company's the economic impact of the achievement gap in America's schools report, Black and Latino students are 2 to 3 years of learning behind white students of the same age. So why is proficiency such an issue when it comes to minorities?
Yes. Minorities, you know, such as the Black community, the Latino community, suffer from the government's refusal to do anything to equip public schools with the correct resources. And a lot of this also has to do with, again, the quality of education. And so what I mean by that is right now our public schools are overcrowded. For example, one teacher can have a classroom of 35 to 40 kids. And when a teacher is faced to, when a teacher is put into a position where they have to manage that many students, the students themselves will suffer because, you know, a teacher realistically can't pay attention to that many students, especially when students need that much attention in their formative years where they actually develop their literacy skills. And so what we're seeing in the United States right now, and actually for a very long time, is that the classrooms expand. There's more kids in classrooms, but there's less teachers. The teacher turnover rate is also ridiculous because a lot of teachers enter the profession. They see that they're treated very poorly by the administration, by the government itself. The salary of the teachers is also, you know, stagnating. Like, for example, the average teacher salary in the United States is ranging from anywhere between like $33,000 to $36,000, which is, you can't even afford a one-bedroom apartment with that sort of money.
According to the U.S. Department of Education, nearly 130 million American adults read below a sixth grade level. This number signifies more than half of the U.S. adult population. The Department of Education and National Institute of Literacy have also reported that 32 million adults cannot read at all. Adding this to the alarming statistics that show two-thirds of American children living in poverty have no books at home, and the number of families living in poverty is only rising. Why can't 32 million Americans read at all?
Isn't that a shameful number? It's just, it should be an embarrassment to the rest of the world. You're asking, how is that possible? Why did that happen? And I think I have to go back to this view that there are certain people, many people in the United States who are viewed as throwaway people, as people who are not useful and not important, and society does not invest in them the way that other people are invested in. Why are there so many people kind of at the bottom and who stay at the bottom? I think it's because our society, and you know, it's capitalism is the basis for relations in our society.
Now, literacy, it can help in leveling socioeconomic inequalities that exist predominantly in minority communities. One Gallup estimate shows that illiteracy has a 30 to 42% effect on the lifetime earning of each individual. It can also generate trillions of dollars of annual income for a country. Now, the average annual income of adults at the minimum literacy proficiency level is roughly $63,000, but those at the lowest literacy levels earn only $34,000 a year on average.
So literacy is creating a workforce that is not really equipped to do technical jobs, that's not really equipped to do professional jobs. So it's creating a workforce of low-paying jobs. It's also creating a workforce of people that are just not going to be able to access higher education. And this also adds to the unemployment crisis as well. Many Americans, millions face unemployment. And, you know, the head of the Federal Reserve has even gone as far to say that they need unemployment in order to fight inflation, which is just outright ridiculous.
The U.S. Department of Justice has data showing that 75% of state prison inmates are either low literate or have not completed high school. Also, the Literacy Project Foundation reports that 3 out of 5 inmates in prison cannot read, and 85% of youth offenders struggle with reading. The Washington State Institute for Public Policy found in a study that by providing general education to people in prison, recidivism is reduced by 7%.
To the extent that people cannot read and write and numeracy, which maybe is a parallel skill, kind of how well can they work with numbers, numeracy, that affects many aspects of people's lives. It affects their jobs, what types of jobs they can function properly in. It affects their ability to navigate the world, just the world of running their personal lives, running their households, even things like shopping or engaging with a bureaucracy for one reason or another.
In 2013, the U.S. Department of Education's National Center for Education Statistics released the results of the program for the International Assessment of Adult Competencies. The program presented an overview of proficiency in adult literacy, numeracy, and problem solving. People born after 1980 in the U.S. scored lower than 15 of the 22 participating countries, and the overall U.S. adults scored below the international average in all three categories and ranked almost at the bottom in numeracy.
Yeah, literacy has been in decline year after year. A range of things really affect literacy in the United States, but I would say the main crisis lies within the quality of education, which is impacted by a teacher shortage, and just the refusal to do really anything to improve the quality of education from a curriculum standpoint.
The drastic literacy statistics is not any better for American children. According to the U.S. National Center for Education Statistics, 34% of students are below basic reading levels in the fourth grade, and 31% are below the proficient reading level. Now, even in the eighth grade, 27% of children are below the basic and 39% below the proficient reading level. So what is the government doing to address this problem of literacy?
First, I think it's important to understand that education is primarily a responsibility of local government in the United States. The federal government, the national government provides some funding, and as do the next level down, which are the states. They're similar to provinces, for example, in other countries. But much of the actual funding and administration is done at the local level. And in some localities, in some towns and subdivisions, they are prosperous, they are relatively wealthy, and they provide a high level of financial support and other types of support to the local schools. The reverse is also true, that in other areas, lower income areas, there is much less support. Good teachers tend to be attracted to the better schools.
Now the problems with literacy levels in schools contributes significantly to the rate of high school dropouts. 1 in 6 high school students, or about 1.2 million teenagers, drop out of U.S. high schools every year. The Children's Reading Foundation states that this problem starts from kindergarten. Students who are behind when they start kindergarten are those who constitute the largest portion of school dropouts.
The dropping out of high school is very, very tragic again. I think this also ties down to back to what I said earlier about schools being ill-equipped with resources and teachers being overburdened. Students aren't able to get a valuable education. They don't have the proper resources. And also, you also have to understand that a lot of students actually have to resort to getting jobs early in order to provide for their own household. We see students as young as 15, 16, having to work extra long hours just to provide for their family. And a lot of these students are forced to drop out because they see getting money for their family as more important than trying to, you know, further their education, which is completely reasonable when you're living paycheck to paycheck, when you have poor food quality, when you are facing eviction every day, every week. And so students dropping out of school is a result of, again, the lack of the government here to do anything to improve the quality of its own citizens' lives.
Back in October, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that the U.S. is falling back on education. He said the rest of the world is starting to out-educate us. Early education is earlier and more prevalent in European countries. A significant number, we rank number 34 out of 37 industrial nations in the world in the number of where we rank in terms of people getting a degree beyond high school.
I would argue the federal government is doing next to nothing. They always try to like rewrite curriculum or give all these like not great checks to state governments. And what state governments do is, you know, they end up bargaining with what we call, but basically private schools, right? Due to some laws here, a lot of that money ends up getting funneled to private schools. And private schools already have, you know, the advantage over public schools, because if you're rich, you can send your child to private school, and then they're able to siphon that money off from public schools. So even if the government does something, you know, the more rich and wealthy sectors of society end up benefiting off of that help because of the way the system works. It's not designed to help.
African American communities have endlessly been under systemic inequities and are disproportionately affected by illiteracy. Poverty and lack of good quality schools contributes to the gap between the overall reading skills of African American and white communities. Now, private schools are usually not available in the minority communities, and if they are, high tuition fees will prevent African American children from enrolling.
Racism historically and continues to be very prominent, intense in the United States. That's the short answer. Now the question is kind of how does that play out? How does that reveal itself on a day-to-day or year-to-year basis? And certainly inferior education is a primary method for delivering inferior skills. Lower income people and people of color tend to have inferior schools. Schools in the United States are largely funded at the local level. So if a person lives in a low income area, as do many minority people of color, there is less money that goes into the school, and as a result, these schools are of lower quality.
The inequities in school and community funding is a long-standing practice in the United States. These discriminations are at times aided by how the boundaries are drawn between school districts. These boundaries often cause segregation, and according to a 2019 report by Edbuild, non-white school districts receive $23 billion less than that of predominantly white districts, despite serving the same number of students.
We see that the most oppressed and the most working class sectors of society barely get anything. Even if resources are expended to, say, education is a broad umbrella due to several lawsuits just throughout history. Private schools are able to siphon off money from public education even, and due to even just like the way for example, a very segregated city like Chicago operates, right? One side of the city is going to have, you know, a decent amount of public education resources, the wealthy side, just based off tax brackets and how tax works. While meanwhile, on say, like the more oppressed sides of the city, right, their tax dollars aren't working for them. Their tax dollars are instead being siphoned off into the police system, which actually oppresses them further. And again, going back to what I said earlier.
The literacy crisis, or any other crisis for that matter, in the United States has not stopped the government or the U.S. House of Representatives Armed Services Committee from increasing spending on the American war machine. Now, the committee backed a $37 billion increase to Joe Biden's already record $773 billion budget proposal for the Pentagon. This is while the Senate Armed Services Committee has already backed a $45 billion increase in its version of the bill.
It's very tragic, the amount of illiteracy that we face in the United States. People are competing for the very bottom to get low-paying jobs. And many of these people can't even get those jobs because you need some level of literacy. So this is creating a very large unemployed workforce. You know, a lot of these people then have to resort to, for example, crime or other jobs that are not officially on the market, black market jobs, for example. So that in and of itself creates systematic causations that basically say, you know, there's a large unemployed workforce, and that's going to not only drain society, it's going to create crime, it's going to create, you know, poverty, it's going to create a large homeless population. So illiteracy in the United States is, the more it increases, the more of these ills in society that we see. And, you know, the United States also refuses to do anything to correct those symptoms.
The U.S. Army has also dropped its mandate for recruits to have a high school diploma or GED certificate in order to enlist for military service. This new policy is amid the Army's recruiting crisis. The reputation of the U.S. military was already dire in terms of the killing of innocent people. Now, by attracting soldiers with lower educational skills, the Army does not have to worry about the new soldiers reading or writing about their potential victims.
The United States military establishment requires volunteers. It does not now have a draft, a military draft. And so what they need to do is get young people in the 16, 17, 18, 19-year-old range to join the military. And the military is especially appealing to young people who have no other future. They don't see themselves as going to college. They don't have a profession or occupation. They have no place to go. And so the military provides some solution for them.
The illiteracy crisis in the U.S. has been longstanding, with little or no progress for years, and at times it's even gone backwards. The lack of progress raises the question that keeping some people illiterate and maintaining this status quo might be intentional. Now, by keeping certain communities like African American and other minorities poverty-stricken and illiterate, the government seems to be hoping to be able to control these masses more effectively. Well, that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and join us next time for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. It is 43 years now that the people organized magnificent rallies on the 22nd of Bahman or on Quds Day. Is this a sign that the people have turned their backs on the revolution? This is a reason for the loyalty, resistance, and steadfastness of the people. It is a reason that Imam's lessons have influenced our great and honorable nation. At the end of my statements, I want to offer some recommendations to activists in revolutionary, social, political, and economic areas. Other young activists or others, I want to offer a number of recommendations. One is that you should not let anti-revolutionary forces and the enemy eliminate the identity of your revolution. You should not let the enemy show the truth of the revolution upside down. This is one recommendation which is important. Intelligent and wise youth should think on this. The next recommendation is that you should not allow the memory of Imam to be undermined in society. As I said, Imam is the soul of the revolution. You should not let Imam's memory be undermined. You should not let Imam be distorted.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The next recommendation is that you should not let reactionary forces infiltrate and settle in the country. What does reactionary mean? When we say reactionary, some people begin to think of an Arakchin, an Islamic skullcap. No, a reactionary person is a person who follows the Western lifestyle and politics. This is a reactionary person. This used to be the case in our country. At the time of the corrupt and dependent Pahlavi rule, the Western lifestyle was prevalent in the country. But the revolution came and rejected it. Anyone who returns to the lifestyle is a reactionary person. A reactionary person might wear a t-shirt or jeans or a bow tie and French perfume, but they are reactionary. Anyone who moves towards the Western lifestyle and culture is reactionary. You should not let your country move towards a reactionary attitude. You should not let reactionary attitude find its place in the body of the country.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. You've done for me through all my years.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Europe is currently experiencing a heat wave. It means that overall energy consumption is lower than usual. However, winter is fast approaching. The EU has cut energy imports from Russia in retaliation for the war in Ukraine. The bloc has agreed deals with the US, Norway and Qatar to import liquefied natural gas.
Is this enough? No, I don't think it is enough. And this is the reason why on July the 20th we will come with further proposals.
If these proposals fall short, the EU faces a major energy crisis this winter. Economists are already painting a very gloomy picture.
We believe that we are going to face a recession during the winter, given all the headwinds we are facing right now, the energy situation, but also the cost of living situation that is having a strong impact on consumption.
Eurozone finance ministers claim all the blame rests with Moscow.
We started our meeting with a discussion on the economic situation, which continues to be challenging due to the impact of Russia's military aggression and all the global developments that arise from that.
Analysts say EU leaders are hurting their own citizens by placing enormous sanctions on Moscow. At the same time, Russia's economy seems to be performing well. Aside from soaring energy and food prices in the EU, there is worrying volatility in financial markets. The European Central Bank is raising interest rates. The euro is currently very weak, which has the effect of pushing up inflation even more. Croatia is due to become the 20th member of the Eurozone in January. The EU describes this as an historic step. The question is, will Croatians have much to celebrate by the time they start using the struggling euro? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
French President Emmanuel Macron has become the highest profile name tarnished by the so-called Uber files, a massive leak of company documents. The whistleblowing appears to detail the ride-hailing company's lawbreaking and collusion with political elites across the West. While economy minister under his predecessor, François Hollande, Macron apparently held secret meetings which resulted in secret deals that undermined laws created to regulate Uber, satisfy taxi drivers, protect passengers, and honor the national labor code. French leftist parliamentarians have openly accused Macron of favoring the interests of an American company over those of his own government. Macron faced similar accusations in 2015 when he guided the sale of French energy giant Alstom to America's General Electric. A defiant Macron shockingly said he would, quote, do it again tomorrow, even though Uber's promises of good jobs and economic prosperity have resoundingly failed in France and elsewhere and caused many indebted taxi drivers to commit suicide.
Taxi drivers are not surprised. We saw that Uber is not good at creating jobs, but for creating a new type of slavery. We love our jobs and our cities, and passengers understood that, and Uber has lost here. Uber dangerously does not respect the laws over and over again, while Macron needs this type of behind-the-scenes lobbies to inflict his type of politics.
Macron has often been accused of attempting the Uberization of all of French society. The accuracy of that criticism appears more just than ever.
Uber has reaped the consequence of their nonsense in France because the government refused to control them with our laws. Uber is more expensive than taxis now and not popular. The Uber market can compete with the taxi market, but there has to be regulation.
The scandal is a reminder that while Western liberal economics claims to be based on fair, free market competition, political corruption is routinely employed to create monopolies, inequalities, and to subvert democratic laws. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A outside Belgium's largest asylum application centre, located at Le Petit Château, close to Brussels city centre. Dozens try to sleep, while dozens more queue up as they wait for the centre to open.
I claimed asylum 1 year ago and I still have nowhere to sleep. You can see all the people on the streets. There's no place to eat or to have a shower.
Look at them. You can see the situation. This situation has been from a long time ago. When you climb asylum, so you shouldn't be in the street like this.
We escaped war in Afghanistan. We came here for help, but have to sleep on the streets and in the park. There is no help for us.
These homeless people are mainly from African countries and Afghanistan. None are from Ukraine. On the face of it, this might look like a Belgium problem, but perhaps we should be pointing the finger at the EU. The 27-country bloc has bent over backwards to provide housing and education for Ukrainian refugees and deliver a whole host of other benefits. Of course, nobody could argue with that. But is this not discrimination? That's a question we put to the European Commission.
Is there a two-tier unfair asylum system in the EU?
We work closely with the member states that they have under their competence and with our support. They need to follow up and ensure contingency planning and adequate support for all those fleeing war and persecution so that there is no difference in their treatment.
Critics say Western nations tore countries in Africa and the Middle East apart and now turn their backs on displaced citizens. This as there is no end of money to support Ukrainians. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan in August 2021 is considered as one of President Biden's biggest failures. The NBC News revealed that the White House and U.S. agencies have started discussions on how to handle the anniversary of withdrawal to prevent further political damage to the president. Afghan experts believe that by reversing the truth, the Biden administration will try to sweep their failures under the carpet and turn a blind eye on the miseries of Afghans whose lives were spoiled by messy withdrawal.
The U.S. and Western propaganda have always had the skill of broadcasting historical events in a way they want. The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan has not been an exception to this rule. It's clear that the U.S. will whitewash its withdrawal mission in its anniversary to keep their global prestige. While we and the world witnessed the U.S. mess in the withdrawal from Afghanistan, as a result of their failure, a political system collapsed, NATO-Afghanistan agreement was broken, and dozens of Afghans were devastated. Most importantly, the U.S. lost its reputation as NATO gendarme.
Shahir, who is in hiding, was left behind by the U.S. He and his family members were asked to come to the airport, but weren't airlifted. He is angry with the U.S., and is still shocked from the sorrowful, frustrating, and insulting evacuation process. He says he feels betrayed by the U.S.
When I made it to the gate of the airport along with my family members, the NATO forces were firing bullets and tear gas everywhere. Inside Kabul airport, we witnessed four Afghans shot dead and three others injured by the U.S. forces. People were panicked, running everywhere. While I was showing my documents, NATO forces hit me with sticks and it started bleeding. Then I gave up as I felt insulted and betrayed by the U.S.
The U.S. 20-year devastating war on Afghanistan ended with a disastrous withdrawal. Several Afghans fell from American aircrafts. Some were shot dead and wounded. Many children were lost. Moreover, a U.S. airstrike hit a house in the airport neighborhoods, killing 10 family members, including women and children. The chaotic evacuation from Afghanistan in 2021 reminds Afghans of those ugly and tragic days. People here blame the ill-prepared U.S. for spoiling the lives of thousands of Afghan people. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Protesters from Palestine Action Scotland scaling the roof of one of the world's largest arms companies in Glasgow, demanding that the facility be shut.